I'm delighted to come and speak to you all today. I am the last thing from a security expert, so I won't be talking very much about security today at all. What I will be talking about is, as David said, a few trends that I've observed in my role, in my current job. I won't be talking about too much of the work that we're doing because most of it is internally focused, but I'll be talking about a lot of the problems that we are trying to solve with the prototypes that we're building. I will also give a disclaimer that I'm not speaking for Microsoft, I'm not speaking for any product plans, nothing I say here is plan of record, except for the already released products that I'll show, which clearly are or were plan of record. So let's get started. So one observation that I made, and I think is pretty obvious, is that the pace of change in the computing industry is really accelerating. If you look at the rate at which new services are being rolled out now, and at which the rate at which new businesses are being brought into the space of computing, whole new industries are being disrupted, and this is now happening on a month-to-month basis. I mean, it used to be a yearly cadence, now it's months or weeks. You can open up, you know, the newspaper a month later and we've moved into some new industry. Computers have released new peripherals that are just changing the capabilities of what's possible. The interfaces with people are changing rapidly. And all of this is driving very, very fast at a world where the capabilities are going to be extremely different from what they are today. And that world is not too far away. So what I tried to do today was to stitch together some of those trends that I think are among the most important, and then I will speculate after each on what some of the new security problems and opportunities might be. And again, the caveat is that you may have already thought of all of these, and you may already be working on them, and there may be papers in this conference already solving the security challenges that I've hypothesized. I'm sure there's at least one, though, that hasn't already been published. So if we look, I got this slide from my old boss, who had a wonderful slide designer. Well, you may not agree, but on some eras of computing, and we started off, you know, in the mainframe era, which they call the first wave of computing. Obviously, there was a mini era in between, but then everyone, you know, got their own computers, and you had a computer on your desk, and then stuff got networked together. And I would say that this community, the security community, has done an amazing job at tackling the security problems that have arisen over the decades as we've moved from one wave or one era to another. So obviously, when your computer gets networked to the internet, you have a whole new host of security problems. You're no longer worried about just physical attacks, but you're worried about network attacks, denial of service attacks. And then we go to cloud computing with cloud services backing mobile phones. And now you have to worry about side channel attacks much more than you did before. You have to worry about Trojan horses in the component supply chain, especially given the vast scale of consumer devices and the vast number of companies participating. So all of these have been really well addressed. And I think there are going to be a new set of challenges that we're going to have to tackle as we move into this next era. What you might notice is that these eras, you know, are accelerating, and as humans tend to have tend to take a first derivative of where they are, that, okay, the world's changed really fast up until now, but it'll look pretty similar because we can't envision what's going to happen a few years from now. But you know, the touchscreen smartphones that we're all holding and the tablets are not going to be what we're using in 10 years. I firmly believe that there are the mobile phone is actually great because it's with you all the time, so you can do all sorts of things with it, but it's actually a pretty terrible interface. It's tiny, you have to peer at it, you can't see very much, it's got limited capacity, it's got limited processing power. Its bandwidth to you is fairly limited, so we really want devices and experiences that give us the full range of computing potential that even the PCs now really haven't tapped. And so I termed this a continuous era, or an era of continuous computing, and I like to joke that as we use more and more mobile services, we're just sampling a discretized computing experience at a faster and faster rate, pull it out of my pocket, check it. Now I'm going to hold it most of the time and check it. It's maybe not good for attention, but we are moving towards an era where we're going to be experiencing services continuously. And one of the really important things in this era is that our attention is preserved and the things that we're interacting with are prioritized so that you're not constantly distracted by garbage. You know, if I'm being hit with a flood of ads in my peripheral vision, that's not good for anybody, except maybe the advertisers. So what does an era of continuous computing look like? Well, first of all, it's natural and low friction. So I want to be able to engage with services very easily. I don't want to have to, if I want to understand, you know, what the weather's going to be like this afternoon, I don't want to pull my phone out of my pocket, pull up a web browser, type in a bunch of stuff on a touchscreen keyboard, wait a while for the antenna to grind, and then get the answer. I want to be able to say, what's the weather? And then I want to know the answer very quickly, hopefully without doing very much physical work. Okay, so that's a very reductive example, and I'll talk some more about more compelling examples. But we really want low friction. We want to be able to engage with these services seamlessly without very much effort, because those increase the fidelity at which we can access them. And they need to be natural. And we've seen a lot more of that with touchscreens and gestures. We've seen that with now a lot more voice interaction. And that's only going to continue. Secondly, the services need to be highly personalized. And I think that's one of the big disruptions that we're just now on the cusp of, and we're starting to see with Google services and Microsoft services and some Apple services, certainly Facebook, that that models are being built about you, and those models are used to customize internet services and online services to your needs. And so those aren't always good. I mean, there's definitely a trade-off that I'll talk about a little while as well, that you know, the services are not always your friends, and the personal data used to personalize the services, having all that out there is a little bit scary. And then finally, to really make it continuous, we need to integrate much more tightly with human senses. Okay, I can do much more with a mobile phone than I can with a PC at my home, because it's with me all the time. And it's gotten a lot closer to me, and they're going to continue to get closer and closer to us. Okay, so what is, just to start thinking about what this architecture looks like, and this is not that far off from what we have today. So the first thing is I have a device on my body, and I'll term that an interface device or a set of interfaces devices. Clearly, I don't want to be a Christmas tree. I don't want to get up in the morning and hang a whole bunch of devices off my body. Maybe I'll grab my phone and my Fitbit, but you know, to me, two is kind of the limit, maybe one, maybe some people three. David is five or six. And so we're going to have a set of things, hopefully in an integrated package, that provide the interface. They provide the input from us to the computer, the output from the computer to us, and they provide the sensors and the actuators that allow us to engage with the infosphere. And then we have a mobile device, which is the hub. It's got a higher bandwidth interface in the form of a screen. It will have the battery. It will have the wireless uplink. And right now, those things are integrated together into a single package. They may stay integrated, they may not. And it's going to hold a large set of the services and data that we need cached locally, because the wireless is so expensive. And so one public piece of work that my group did earlier this year with Oriana, who presented the progressive authentication, or was on the progressive authentication paper earlier at this conference, was the concept of pocket cloudlets that appeared in AskBloss, where you actually cache a large amount of data from the cloud, but also some of the cloud services. And we talked about doing internet search cached locally, where you can actually do very well if you're smart and you have a personalized experience. So this thing is going to be a hub that's going to hold a lot of the services and data locally to give you the fast response time, and interact with these sensors and actuators and UI. Then there's going to be there may be some near devices, because your mobile device on your body is actually fairly limited in terms of the processing power it can do. And for interaction with a lot of these new services, you need some pretty heavy horsepower. And so we'll very commonly find some very powerful devices close by with high bandwidth wireless connections that will be able to offload the really heavy analytics you need for the user interface. And so we may or may not see those depending on the type of UI, but we already know of cases where those exist. And then finally, our second to last, a near cloud, where you have a large amount of data that you need to process quickly to provide the data for the user experience, and you need to get there and back in milliseconds. or maybe somewhere between 10 and 100 milliseconds. And so if you look at online gaming, they have a very, very tight latency bound for you to get there and back. And they're actually OnLive is an example of a startup that's doing online gaming where most of the work, including the rendering, is done in the cloud, and the bits are just shipped to your screen. And they need to get back there and back in 80 milliseconds, and even that has some perceptible lag. So they're building out geographically distributed data centers to provide these services. And then finally, you've got the far large-scale cloud that's going to take a bunch of your data and other people's data and do the large-scale analytics and mining that will build the models of the world and of you that can be shipped down and serve with low latency on the rest of this hierarchy. So this is the sort of architecture that we're going to see to provide these very, very intense, continuous experiences coming up. And there are really three pieces to this that I think we're going to see in practice that will be disruptive. And the first, and I'll just list them and then I'll talk about them each. The first is the computers having a semantic understanding of the real world. So this is, you know, a computer will understand that I'm in a conference room, that there are a set of people in the conference room, who those people are, where they're sitting, those are lights, you know, those are tables, right now a talk is in progress, that understands what's happening, which is really important for things like if it's time to ship you a service, you need to understand what's happening in the room to understand if it's a good time for you to receive that service or not. Okay, there are a few phone calls I would take right now during the talk, but very few. Okay, the fourth time, you know, my spouse calls would probably be one. Okay, but I don't want to make a move in an online game or something during the talk. Okay, that's a silly example. But the semantic understanding is coming, and it's really important. And then, so I'll talk about that first. So this is actually something that mobile phones aren't yet real good at. They're okay, but the Microsoft Kinect, which I'll talk a little bit about in a moment, is one of the best examples now on the mass market that does a really, really nice job. And people think of Kinect and the Kinect equivalents from other vendors as a gaming device. But I really think it's much more than that. As these systems get miniaturized and the cost gets brought down and they get lower power and cheaper, you'll start to see them popping up everywhere. You know, you can build Kinect-like functionality into fixtures in every room and use multiple ones perhaps to build 3D maps, and you can support telepresence that way. But you start to have computers understanding what's happening in all the spaces. And that allows you to do all sorts of different things. So just as a poll, how many people here have actually used a Kinect before? Okay, about half. Great. I gave a talk about 9 months ago, and I would say about 10% of the people had, so this is progress. So for those of you who don't know how it works, a Kinect basically has four sets of sensors and actuators. It has a multi-array microphone, so it can do directional sound and figure out, separate sound channels, so it can separate speakers and figure out who's speaking and try to do the voice processing on individual speakers. So it has a four microphone array. It's got infrared 3D depth sensors, and so basically you have an infrared transmitter that broadcasts a speckle pattern out into the room, and then you have a sensor that reads that speckle pattern back and looks at the deformation of the individual points to try to compute a depth map of the room. And then finally you have an RGB camera to facilitate that as well. So if I look at, let me skip over this. So if I'm just showing you a picture here of what the depth map looks like. It's not regular. It turns out that's better for the speckle pattern in infrared. It turns out that's actually useful for generating better depth maps. And so, I mean, it's pretty reductive right now. The infrared doesn't work outside, which is a big limitation. So it's good for living room scale, and obviously it doesn't get very far back in the room very well. But it's a first step. But you can now understand the shape of partially what's in the room. You can understand where the people are, and obviously you can track their skeletal motions, which is the first use that it was put to commercially. And obviously, if you go on the online and you look for all sorts of different Kinect hacks, you'll see all sorts of amazing stuff. But I wanted to show you one play one quick movie that was produced by Microsoft Research in Cambridge. And I'm not going to play the whole thing. I'm going to jump around a little bit. But what they did is they took a Kinect and built a set of software behind it to do surface reconstruction, so building a very accurate map of the room and the objects in it. And then what they can do is do some mixed reality work by mapping virtual things on top of the physical spaces that they've mapped. So if I just jump ahead here, you'll see on the upper left, there's the raw normal map, the Kinect RGB, which is being used in the upper right. And then in the bottom, they're doing 3D reconstruction using the Kinect. So they're actually building a model. And you can see on the lower lower right there that the dark parts are the parts that haven't yet been filled in. But as they walk around with the Kinect, they use the depth map to build a more a higher and higher quality depth map. You can see there behind the monitor, they're filling that part in. And now you actually have an understanding of the scene. Now what they're not doing here is semantic extraction from the scene or understanding, you know, what the things are. They're just building a map based on what they see. Okay, now once you have that, of course, there's all sorts of neat stuff you can do. And I'll jump ahead here a little bit. So now you've got a... Right, so what they're doing here now is doing physics simulation over these depth maps. So you can see that in the upper, on the top part, they've actually built the depth map of the scene. And now with that depth map, you know, built in, they can start doing particle simulation. And you see on the bottom left, you know, all these virtual globs that are in a ball and then thrown together, and they do the physics simulation and they interact with the real world. Okay. And if you have a very precise depth map, you can actually do very, very well. So, you know, so mixed reality, or what some people call augmented reality, is one use of this, where you can, you know, you can look at virtual content on a real space. The other use, of course, is to actually look at the real space and understand what's in it, so that you can actually figure out what you should be doing. And I think both of these, that's what I call mixed reality. Both of these, you know, the real world informing the virtual world, and then the virtual world augmenting the real world. And I will just, there was one more thing I wanted to put up here at the end. Right, so you can see here an example of new interfaces where once you have the depth map and you can track a hand, now you can start annotating things with virtual information. So now I'm writing on the wall using a finger, writing on the teapot there. And so this, I think you can see that once you have the depth information, once you know all of this, you can start doing interesting new things with interfaces. Creating information, consuming information, et cetera, et cetera. And so these sorts of sensors are actually very interesting, and we're really at the infancy of what these things are going to be able to do. And you can do the same thing with sound. You can, you know, interpret sound and generate, extract speaker source, and then do semantic extraction of the sound. What's happening in the room? You know, right now we're in a talk. One person is speaking into a mic. You know, you could extract all that information as well. Okay, so now when you start extracting semantics from reality, I won't talk so much about augmented reality, but going the other way, extracting semantics from reality, what are some of the security considerations now? Because this is actually going to be a very fundamental thing that's going to be used to both inform our personal services as well as broad services to users. So first of all, we've got tons of sensors and cameras and microphones embedded throughout your life. I mean, you know, we might have depth cameras up in the light fixtures. We've got microphones everywhere, and these are just dumping streams of sensor information into something somewhere that's extracting information that's providing the services people need. Now, so personally, if you have this stuff in your house and you carry some around with you, there's a question about who installs it, who owns it, who manages it. So in a home, the ownership of those is actually not a single person, it's a family. So just like we have with social networks, there are now overlapping ownerships for sensors. So if I have a Kinect in every room or a Kinect equivalent, now my wife and I both own that. We should both be able to access the sensor streams. And so you have this distributed network of sensors dumping information into something, and it's not just my infosphere that I control because it's multiple people, and there's a permissioning layer there that needs to happen. But it's a really tough problem. How can my partially owned network of sensors work together to provide the right information and extract the semantics in a way that leaves me secure? And confidentiality is a big issue, and if that's either through the security hole or through the business model, if that's compromised, you know, I'm really at risk, right? Because people can know, you know, when I'm home, when I'm not home, what activities we're doing in the house, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And that sounds crazy. It sounds creepy. Why would I ever want that? But lots of people are putting Kinects in their living room or in their bedrooms if you have a TV there and that's when you play gaming. And that, so they're already there. And so this is a really important problem. And it's much more complicated than when I had a single machine connected to the network, because a lot of these sensors are going to be decoupled from machines. They're going to be, you know, individual sensors that are connected directly to the network, pumping data into some machine somewhere. So that's a first issue. Then there's the second thing that I think will drive a lot of this continuous computing is the much tighter integration with our senses. So like I said, the mobile phone, terrible user interface, okay, except that it's mobile. And it's getting better and better, but it's still far from what it could be. And so if you look at the sorts of sensors that people are thinking about, you know, I won't talk at length through all of these. Obviously, gestures and voice and speech is one that's been you know, gestures are now more popular. Speech has been worked on for a long time. But there's a lot of work happening, very interesting work happening in the neural arena, with people now able to extract very rough you know, images, or at least reverse solve for them. That's some recent work from Berkeley, if you've seen the movie, trying to use machine learning to extract what a person is thinking about and match it to movies. You know, for biometrics, is I'm sure this community has a lot of expertise in that arena. Chemical. This integration with our bodies and our senses is eventually going to be used to drive health. So a scenario that I think likely is that we'll be monitoring our health on a continuous basis in the not too distant future. You would like to know the day you get sick, not 6 months later when you start showing symptoms and then 3 weeks later when they haven't gone away and you go to the doctor. And the doctor said, boy, I wish you would have come in 3 months ago. So, you know, this tight integration we're going to start seeing, and with these personal models we'll be solving for both our biometrics and our physiology, as well as against models of large populations, maybe tuned to our DNA, but we'll definitely be doing continuous analysis, daily blood work, for example. And this will have the potential for much better health. It also has the potential for really catastrophic leakage of information. And then on the output side, lots of people are experimenting with pico projectors. I'll show something in just a moment. Computational holography is another one where you're generating light fields. So that you actually see what the virtual image should be. The same thing with virtual generation of sound fields, touch. So there's just a ton of things that people are playing with, and some of these are definitely going to hit. So just as again, another example from MSR with Chris Harrison, Desney Tan, and Dan Morris, you know, what they did is use what I like to call body seismology, where they actually wear a sensor, which is an armband you can see in the upper left there, that monitors the shock waves when you touch your skin. In slow motion here, I always find this a little bit creepy. Okay, that you get these seismological waves that propagating through your body. You can do the same thing for electrical signals as well. And then you do machine learning to understand where they've hit to reverse solve for, based on the wave the sensor receives, where are they hitting. And then you can use that to drive an interface. And so I'll just jump ahead here. So there's playing Tetris on your hand by touching your fingers, using a pico projector as a whimsical example. Let me just jump ahead. And then there's using your skin to select buttons. You know, so is this an ideal user interface that's better than the phone? No, but it's in its infancy, and you can see how you can use rich signals about your body to interact with it, with the infosphere. And so, you know, which one of these we'll start to see, we don't know. But this tighter coupling is definitely coming. So then now to the security considerations. Here, the data leaks are even more personal and dangerous. So you know, if you're extracting neural information, you may start to think about Minority Report-like scenarios where if it leaks or somebody is tracking it, they'll say, oh, you know, I don't like where these brain waves are going. Even your physiology, you know, is this person a candidate for depression? Are they exhibiting signals that correspond to a meltdown? Is your health deteriorating? Do you get laid off, et cetera, et cetera? But there's also the possibility, and I think this is more interesting, of direct physiological damage. So if you have these sensors and actuators very tightly coupled with your senses, whether it's sending beams of sound directly to each ear from a speaker, whether it's in-ear ear plants, whether it's you've got very tight contact lenses people have looked at actually generating photons, you can have attacks where you actually try to damage the senses. Those are obvious. But more subtle things are denial of attention attacks, where somebody might beam you a bunch of stuff right as you're crossing the street, or try to startle you with a camera sees that traffic is coming, more subtly again, if I have a hack and I'm a salesman trying to sell you something, if I can just distract you right at the right times, maybe I can manipulate you, or even more subtle, using sub-threshold signals, noise or sight, to actually do physiological damage or try to program you in different ways. All right, so these are all, in some sense, these are body hacks, and the potential for subtlety is very distressing, and the potential for damage is distressing as well. And so this is one that I've been really worried about and harping on for some time. And I'm not going to talk about solutions, but personal data is something that I think is taking us to a very scary place if we don't address the way we use it. So I've talked about the computers understanding the semantics of rooms and the environment to be able to use that knowledge to generate new interfaces and new services. I've talked about new interface modalities coming that will couple us much more tightly to computation. But the personalization of services is something that's going to come. It's going to come very fast, and it's going to come very hard. And we're going to have things that are really, really, really tightly attuned to us, not just to our moods and not just for advertising, but, for example, the system will know everything I own. And when something breaks, I'll have a little device driver for the thing that broke, that where I can download a new version and print it in my 3D printer. Okay, people have talked about having all of the things that you own up for continuous auction, where you set the threshold. How much would it take for me to part with my couch? If anyone wants it, you get a notification. I've talked about the continuous health monitoring. The closing of commercial intent. So what do I actually need to buy that will really improve my quality of life, as opposed to advertising, which is trying to trick me into something that I don't want to buy? So advertising is sort of, if there's a 0% chance that you want it, and recommendation is there's a 100% chance you want it. And of course, both advertising and recommendations are typically somewhere in between. So closing of commercial intent, recreation, just education is another one. The system will know what I know. It will know how best to explain things to me, what order it should quiz things to me to maximize my learning rate. When do I learn best? Based on my blood sugar? When is it best to quiz me on things or give me a new concept? Education will be revolutionized by this very, very tight coupling with personalization. So, and these things are all going to come. And actually not too long from now. A lot of it's happening even today. But the problem is that as everything goes digital, or almost everything goes digital, every time we interact with a sensor, we're spewing off some personal information. Every time we interact with a digital service, we're generating some digital information. And as more and more services go digital, then we generate more and more of this digital exhaust. And so, I have an image of a person here, and so we're constantly pumping out this digital exhaust now, represented by the white arrows. And right now that exhaust is being grabbed by third parties and mined to build profiles of us, sometimes on our behalf to ship us services, other times just to build profiles of us to try to sell us things we don't want, or for more nefarious purposes, you know, to use against you in some way, whether it's to jack up your insurance premiums, to build a dossier on you, or whatnot. And of course, as companies aggregate a lot more of this personal information, governments are actually, it's very easy for governments to get this personal information on request from the companies. So, you know, what I would very much like to see is that we build a firewall around this personal information, and you have a hood, you know, for those of you who remember your chemistry classes, that capture that information and allow you to leverage it on your own behalf, but you're not spewing it out all over the place. And so these green dots here, to me, represent services that I've brought inside my circle of protection to actually personalize the services. So you can think of those as lenses where I bring external services in, personalize them within my hood or my circle, and get the services without throwing this data off all the time. And what I'd really like to do is to have something that captures all my data and never lets any of it out unless I want it to leak out, you know, to acquire some service. And you know, you might think this is silly, or some of you might say it's obvious. It's certainly not obvious to the industry right now. And you know, maybe right now with just sending off your location, it's not such a big deal, or some other things. But if you look at where we're going with all of these sensors and all of these interfaces, it's really scary to think of all of that information being sprayed out there, especially if it's health related. And so, of course, you know, we do interact with external services, and you know, you leak some information whenever you interact with a service, unless you have a fully anonymizing proxy. And even then, the proxy gets some information. But what I really want is the ability to bring as much of the personalization within my circle as I can so I get good quality services. And then when I want to, let some data leak out to acquire some other service. But the terms of use of those data need to be governed by policy. And this is a huge user interface challenge. But I really, really want to see a system and an ecosystem and a set of personal infospheres where when I interact with a service, my preferences have been recorded by my infosphere, and those preferences are engaged in policies that are legally binding, and those policies are sent with the data, and so the recipient party is restricted in what they can do with my data. So I like to think of this red thing as what I'll call a Fourth Amendment circle, you know, if you're in the U.S., which really states that, you know, all of this information is really mine. Now, there's a legitimate debate to be had about whether, you know, information about me is a paper or a possession, as written in the Constitution. And, you know, there's a lot of gray area there, but I think this is going to be really important, given how deeply personal a lot of this information is going to be. So, obviously, this has big implications for, you know, software architecture and operating systems and the mobile ecosystem and advertising and all of this. But where we're going is going to make this more and more important. I really don't believe the people that say that privacy is dead and, you know, people don't care about their privacy and we're moving into a world where everything you do will be visible to all people at all times, simply because some of the information is just so sensitive that you can't afford to have it out there. And the problem is that you don't know what the sensitive information is. Some of it is clearly sensitive, others of it can be used to infer things that are sensitive, and you don't know a priori what the risk models are. So if I think about what the security considerations are, so for this personal data vault or personal infosphere, I need strong, very strong protection. That's something that this community, that you all know how to do very well. It's certainly harder against across a collection of ad hoc devices where some are clients and some are in the cloud and devices are constantly coming in and out of that network. You know, I throw away my phone, I get a new one, and I might share some devices, but I think, you know, people know at least the principles of how to solve that. We need a policy framework to manage the terms of use in our organization. You know, the security group wrote, you know, the security and policy and authorization language, SecPAL, which is a very nice language to do this sort of stuff, and there are certainly others. You know, so that's, I think, known, you know, we know how to do that. The harder things are that we need guaranteed mechanisms on the recipient side, for the third parties that I'm interacting with, to ensure that these policies are enforced or that violations are discovered. We don't even have a legal framework now for reasoning about enforcement of these policies across all my personal data. I mean, you know, you can construct it in special cases, but we don't have a generalized legal framework for this yet, and certainly no standards that are widely adopted that govern the terms of use of all of my data that are streaming out there. You know, we can generate those, but we really, really, really need concrete mechanisms on the other side to do enforcement. I'm not willing to just trust that these people are obeying the terms of use of my data and not selling it, you know, and hoping they won't get caught and slapped down with a fine if anyone ever digs through their systems. So that to me is really important and a really important problem that I hope that this community and others solve. And if it's already solved, I'd actually be very interested to know that. And then we also need, and this is an even harder problem, user interfaces that enable users to understand what the security risks are associated with loss of confidentiality. If I give up some data, what are the risks? And that's an incredibly hard problem because we don't really know what the risks are. But if you don't understand what the risks are or what could happen, users have no way to reason about how bad it is for them to release these data or not. Right? Should I treat this data as sensitive or not? Is it okay for me to give you my location? Well, I don't know. So, and you know, location is probably the easiest or one of the easiest to reason about. Others are much more subtle. So, you know, we both need to really understand what the risks are and then drive those up into the user interfaces so users can make informed decisions, because they're not going to be policy authors. They're not going to be able to reason about this very much at all. They're going to make a few simple settings and then go from there, or maybe import them from privacy advocates or third parties. So this is a very hard problem, but I think it's fundamental. And then, you know, in this world, authentication obviously becomes even more important than it is today. So as I generate more important and more intimate personal data for these services, you know, I camera sees everything that I see, and that's recorded, et cetera, et cetera. Then if somebody can impersonate me, the loss is even more catastrophic, especially as these infospheres are now getting more and more integrated, brought together, you know, a single getting in. Once you're inside, you have everything. And there's a trade-off here, because you want to make it harder to get in, but we're spewing more and more personal data out into the world, and that makes it easier to impersonate a person. Okay, so you know, in the pre-digital era, impersonation was really hard because you had to look and talk like the person and figure out their social networks in a small town, right? Now it's you know, all of this information about all of us is there: our picture, our birthday, you know, our family tree, and you all know a lot more about this than I do. So personal data can be used, if you think about biometrics and other things, can be used to improve authentication, but it also weakens privacy. So if I throw all this out there, and an example is, you know, if I tell my bank where I am at all times, it's easier for them to say whether a purchase is fraudulent or not. And you know, one thing we've been working on is a scheme where you can do this, you know, you can close that loop without giving the banks your information, but allow them to verify. And certainly other people are working on things like that too. So you really want the personalization and the security guarantees, but also the privacy. So you know, one thing that we started working on that Oriana and Dimitrios and Chuan and Karen did a very nice job of, and that was presented earlier in this conference, was saying, can we use this personal information to improve security by bringing together many, many signals that will be hard to impersonate? So if I get your PIN, I can unlock your phone, but if the attacker needs to know where you were over the last 48 hours, that's a lot harder, or how you hold the phone, or what temperature your pocket typically is. I mean, they took a whole bunch of different signals and brought those up and built models and tried to combine them so that multimodal, deeply personalized set of models would be very, very hard to replicate. And then you get a fairly granular confidence interval. The problem with that, of course, is that all of this information is now being stored, and if it's all leaked out, then A, an attacker can build the models, and B, you know, you lose your privacy. So we want to really keep those data private so it's harder for people to build the models of you and attack that way. Okay, so I have just a few more minutes, and so I wanted to switch gears here a little bit. And so, you know, all that stuff is the set of the future applications that my team and you know, people my collaborators like David have been working on and trying to envision and thinking holistically about the experiences and the technology and the privacy problems and all that together. There's another imminent disruption coming, and I thought, and since this is really my core area in architecture, that I'd talk a little bit about it here. For the security community, and think about what some of the issues might be. So there's a lot of debate going on right now about when Moore's Law will end, but I think everyone knows that it's not a law, it's a temporary period of exponential growth. And you know, we're coming up on the end of it, at least that's my opinion. And you know, Gordon Moore published the original paper in 1965, so we've had a really good run. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what some of the implications are, and then what changes that will likely drive in the hardware ecosystem, and what some of the security implications might be. All right, so I'm really coming at this from two sides, on the experience and application side, and now on the underlying infrastructure side. So I don't know whether this is widely known in this community or others, but there was a seminal paper in 1974 by Dinard and his colleagues that laid out a set of scaling rules for transistors and how you shrink them down over time. And that came to be known as Dinard scaling. And basically what he said is you scale everything linearly in such a way, you know, the dopant atoms in the transistor channel, the thickness of the insulator on the transistor that separates the gate, which is the on-off switch, from the channel, which is where the electrons flow. You scale all of it proportionally, and with that set of scaling rules, you keep the electric field across the insulator constant. So that was the one thing they held constant. And that set of scaling rules turned out to be incredibly helpful. And so every generation, when you would shrink the transistors and scale down one process node, you know, which happens every 2 to 3 years, and lately it's been every 2 years, you get this amazing result of twice as many transistors. Each transistor runs 40% faster, and despite the fact that you have twice as many devices and they're all running faster, you run at the same power as you did in the previous generation. So things are getting a lot more energy efficient, and a lot faster, and a lot smaller, okay, exponentially over decades. And that's what's really driven us to these levels of performance that we see here. Unfortunately, Dinard scaling broke about half a decade ago, a little more now, and one of the principal causes was because the insulators were getting so thin that they couldn't scale them down anymore without getting too much electrical leakage across your insulator. You know, at some point they were 5 atoms thick, and they've gone to new materials and exotic materials and pumped them back up, but they lost that part of the scaling, and so everything is sort of broken down. And the implications for that breakdown, the primary implication, is that we can no longer scale down the voltage of the transistors the same way we were, which means that now, as we're doubling the number of transistors, we're packing a lot more transistors on a chip, but they're not getting as much more energy efficient, and so our power density is going up. Whereas before it was flat, now it's going up exponentially over generations. Okay, and so that's why you hear people talk about power and energy being this big crisis. It's because of the failure of Dinard scaling. So if we look at where we are and what the technology roadmap looks like, we're at 2012, obviously, and 22 nanometers in the top column, and you can integrate on a large chip 32 billion transistors. I mean, obviously, it's proportional to chip size. But the red shaded area there is where things start to get really squirrely, because we're now running up the power density. And what that means is that you really only have three choices if you're in that mode. You can increase the power that the chips consume, 100 watts this generation, 180 watts next generation, 280 watts the next generation. That's not an option. We're trying to go the opposite way. You can make the chips smaller, so you can just do the same thing you were doing before, maybe a little bit more, and things get cheaper, but not better. Or you can employ what's called dark silicon, where you leave a bunch of the chip powered off, and then you light it up selectively as you need different portions of it. Okay, so I put 1,000 accelerators on my chip, some for security, some for user interfaces, and when I'm actively using that part, I power down part of the chip, power up another part of the chip. That works for a little while, but it obviously doesn't scale either. And so we really have three outcomes from when we move into this sort of danger zone where transistors are incredibly variable, where they're leaky, they're failing all the time. You know, they don't get much better. And really what I'm worried about is the economics breaking before our ability to shrink them breaks. And so my personal guess is 8 nanometers or 2018 is where we'll sort of hit the last node that's profitable. You know, obviously it's a big section of big area of debate, but that's only about 6 years away. So, you know, three outcomes. We solve the power problem somehow. We get a magic material. You know, we discover it on Mars and bring it back, and it works really well. And we then just sprint down to the atomic limits. How low can we go with the physics? We figure out great dark silicon designs, which I think is unlikely. Or scaling then becomes a cost play, and we just start shrinking our chips. But under no circumstances is energy free. And some people have said, and this is maybe a hobby horse of mine, well, we've shifted to multi-core, and we're just going to keep on increasing the number of cores, and multi-core is energy efficient, so we're good. We'll just, you know, scale from 16 today to thousands of cores eventually. My group did a study about a year and a half ago to try to debunk this. And so on the y-axis here, you have the speed up from the present day, actually a couple generations ago. On the x-axis, it's year, which is equivalent to process node. And then the white line shows what our historical scaling rate in terms of performance has been. The red and blue lines show what you get under the current technology projections if you try to scale the core counts. And the red line's technology projections are wildly optimistic. So it's going to be much more close to the blue line. The dotted blue line that ends up in 6 times performance improvement over 10 years is actually what you get with applications that are 99% parallel. So even if you have wildly parallel applications, the power is what really limits you. And these numbers are for if you can find the optimal multi-core design with any number and size of cores you want at any technology generation. And so our paper on that was in ISCA 2011, if you're interested. So I think the bottom line there is that multi-core is not going to bail us out, and the performance returns from multi-cores are diminishing and unlikely to grow rather radically. So I don't have time to dig into this in great detail, but there are really four, I think, directions that architectures and hardware are likely to go. So number one, as I've already mentioned, is volume. So rather than trying to make chips better or faster, we can just make orders of magnitude more small chips. And the number of chips we can produce grows exponentially with process node. What that does is it completely collapses the cost structure. And you know, the industry needs to move to new economic models. But what it enables, you know, you can have processors for a tenth of a penny, and you can put processors with a wireless connection into everything. You know, some people call that the Internet of Things. You know, Intel is certainly investing a lot in that model just in case. So there's some pretty interesting security questions there, you know, if everything is enabled, but we really don't know what that model will look like and what people will use it for. And there's, I think, legitimate questions about whether that's actually a useful thing to do. So that's one strategy. The second is integration, and that's happening now. You know, people are integrating memory into the same package. All of the functionality that we used to have on motherboards is getting integrated onto system on chips. So in some sense, the chip is the new motherboard. I don't know what implications that has for security. The last two are more interesting, though. So one is specialization, where we are now building specialized components for the software. And you know, what's likely to happen is that general purpose chips will stop advancing. And at that point, the only way you get more performance is to specialize for your current software workload, which inevitably leads to some sort of rapid hardware software co-design. So I would imagine in 10 years, you'll have an application, you'll run it through a set of tools, maybe 20, because the tools challenge is really hard. You know, the tools will extract the performance critical part of the software, synthesize it to design, you'll mail it off, you'll have an ASIC back in a couple weeks in a standard form factor that you'll slide into your server or your workstation, and that application will be greatly accelerated. Security challenges there, well, I'll talk about those in the next slide. So that I think we're likely to see a rapid ASIC industry to do hardware software co-design for general applications arise very quickly. And then finally, I think another area that's likely to see a big growth is approximation, where you start reducing the precision of computation for applications that can accept fuzzy results to get more efficiency. So analog circuits, you know, low threshold circuits, just you know, fewer bit widths and whatnot. And so we've actually recently started using neural networks to sit on the side of a general purpose processor and train themselves based on observing the processor, and then you can call the neural network instead of a function. And you lose a little precision, but you get a big jump in performance and efficiency. So what are the security implications? For specialization, as these systems become collections of IP blocks, you know, can from many providers, can the providers be trusted? As you're wiring all these different IP blocks together, these different silicon blocks together onto a chip, you know, what are the new security holes? Because you have a very complicated messaging infrastructure. They all interact with each other in different ways. You know, what new security holes and attacks will come as a result of that complex communication? And then, you know, what new exploits? You know, we have buffer, lots more buffer overruns, things like that. And then on approximation, if you're doing more analog style computation, you have the opportunity to disrupt computation by generating noise. So by generating electromagnetic noise, you know, it's another side channel attack, but you can actually disrupt the computation rather than just observing and trying to infer secrets. We'll call it a denial of precision attack. And then I think it's probably unlikely, but I would have thought a lot of the side channel attacks are unlikely too. Can noise insert malicious results into a victim application that's using approximate computation? Can you time the noise in such a way to move the computation where you want it to be? Okay, so to conclude, I think we're moving into an era of great opportunity with these new services and great peril. Some of them sound really creepy to me, but I think they're coming, whether they're creepy or not. And so, you know, I really, really think we need to focus on, you know, regaining people's privacy, especially as we get much more intimate with the machines. And security, you know, attacks in this space will be, this is a new Windows 8 feature, will be catastrophic. We have three birthdays tomorrow. That's part of my conclusions. And then I guess the last thing I would ask is for you all on the message, one message I'd like you all to take away is please don't accept the consensus that privacy is dead and we don't have to worry about the security of your private data because it's going to be out there anyways. I really don't like where everything is going if you lose all of your data and all of your privacy. And I think if that world happens, it will inhibit a lot of these potentially great services, particularly in the health space. But more than that, it takes us to a scary place if everything and everybody, including companies and the government, know everything about you. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Alan Sherman, UMBC. What role do you see for the emerging new high-tech glasses? For example, David Chaum has a company, Spectacular, that has a lightweight form factor that projects high-definition computer display.
You mean glasses like glasses that you wear?
Eyeglasses, yes.
Eyeglasses.
Wearable, mobile, lightweight, see-through.
Well, certainly Google has announced their Google glasses. And I think if you can make them work with low power and wide field of view, you have that's another component in the interface that's really interesting. It's a pretty hard technical problem. I don't know if you wanted me to say more than that.
How disruptive do you think that technology is? And you're a very creative, forward-looking person. I wondered what you thought the implications of those radical technologies might be.
So I think one implication, so you know, if you can have continuous immersive screens, that would obviously be very disruptive, whether you're wearing them on the head or whether you're wearing them on the arm or whether they're contact lenses rather than eyeglasses. So it's exciting, potentially disruptive technology. Obviously, the power implications are, you know, you've got large screens that have to be high def. The optics are tricky. You know, people have talked about them for a long time. You know, if they're not transparent, if they're just screens, then they block your view, which limits their use. And then you have all these sorts of things that I was talking about before. You know, you've got possible attacks on what you're seeing. You know, you need cameras so that you've got a continuous camera feed, right? Because you have to be understanding the semantics of the real world as you move through it. and that camera feed is then, you know, so you're potentially uploading everything you see, and that's a little scary too, right? So, you know, is it protected? How do I know that it's safe? How do I turn it off when there's something sensitive? Do I constantly have to go and fiddle with it, you know, if people can make them work? So, I mean, it's a vision that people have talked about for a long time. You know, I don't know how disruptive it will be. I guess time will tell.
Yeah, Gurney Hunt, IBM Research. On your scaling of technology, it was really good, but you seem to have not taken into account other modes, other types of computation, or other materials that might be used. I mean, no matter what material you use, it's going to have some finite range. But
right.
You have, in fact, you've sort of constrained yourself, it seems, to silicon-based technology and not looked at other things like quantum computing or other types of computational methods that people are talking about. Do you have any comments on those?
Lots. I'll try to keep them short. So I think that the graphene work that IBM is doing is really interesting. I'm not a big fan of the carbon nanotubes. The quantum computation is much farther out. So I think we can break these new technologies you're talking about into general purpose, near term, silicon-like compute, and other. And quantum computing to me is other, right? If you look at, if you need to run it at small numbers of Kelvin to make it work, you know, I mean, that stuff is practically maybe a decade out, maybe more. I really don't know. I mean, there's lots of work and great work going on, but that doesn't affect the silicon and the commodity industry roadmap, you know, as we go to the end of Moore's Law. I don't see quantum computing sort of picking up in 2018 and carrying things forward for a few more generations. I think that there are a lot of candidate technologies people are looking at. It's incredibly hard to shift to a new candidate technology, especially if you're already down near atoms and you only have one or two more generations to go anyways. I mean, the cost of that is astronomical. So like gallium arsenide is you know, really fast, but it's pretty power hungry and probably not going to replace CMOS. You know, it would be great to have a magical material. Graphene looks really promising, but it's still pretty far away from being able to be, you know, manufactured at scale. There are a lot of resistive memory technologies like phase change and resistive RAM and spin torque transfer, MRAM, all those sorts of things that I think are promising on the memory side that we'll likely see some set of at volume when flash and DRAM run out. But on the logic side, I'm actually pretty pessimistic that a new technology will pick up right when CMOS hits a roadblock and then allow us to run for a little while longer. Okay, but you know, people are really creative. I'm betting against innovation. That's a bad thing to do. I'm probably wrong, right? But you get to make the call once, right? And so that's my call. All right, if there are no more questions, thank you all very much for your attention.